All right. Hi, everyone. It's really good to see you all here. My name's Siobhan. I'm a fifth-year journalism international studies student, and I'm a part of Credo, and I'll be the MC for our panel discussion today. So I'm just going to explain a little bit about how we're going to run the discussion before I introduce our panelists. So first off, what we're going to do is we're going to ask some questions that have kind of been pre-prepared, just so each panelist can talk a little bit about where they're speaking from and what their experiences are of sexism. And then what we'll do is we're actually going to have a number up on the screen the whole time, which you can text any questions into that you want to. And the second half of today will be taking those questions and, yeah, we'll probably have about 20 minutes or so to take questions. So numbers up on the screen the whole time. That number actually comes through to my phone here. So if you see me on my phone during the panel, I'm not like really disinterested. I'm going through questions, okay? And at the end, we'll also be asking for feedback on like the running of today. So if you have any like things that you think of throughout the panel, just jot them down. And at the end, there'll be a little incentive to provide some feedback for us. All right, so I think we're ready to get started. All right. So I'll just ask each of you to please introduce yourselves and what worldview you're speaking from today.
Hello, guys. My name is Rima. I've been at the University of Technology for 4 years now. I'm in my last year of biomedical science. So my worldview of that I'm speaking from today is the Islamic perspective. So, yeah.
My name's Ruby. I've actually been at UTS for 6 years now. It's been a while. I'm studying law and communications, and I am the secular perspective on the panel, which is a bit challenging because I guess that doesn't really form a huge part of how I see the world. It's just kind of, I don't have a religious perspective, I guess. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Rani. I'm not a student at UTS, but I work with Credo on the ministry team here. I used to study back in the day. I did a degree in English literature. These days, I'm finishing off a degree in theology. And today, I'll be speaking from an evangelical Christian worldview. And that's just another way of saying that I'm a follower of Jesus. I love the Bible. And I think that the death and resurrection of Jesus have profound implications for everyone. I'm also pretty interested in the way that Christianity and feminism intersect, so I guess I'll be speaking out of that as well.
Great, thanks a lot. So the first question is, what have your experiences of sexism been? So I asked Ruby to go first, if that's all right.
Okay. I guess as a woman, sexism is kind of like a pervasive experience that is kind of manifesting like microaggressions in everyday experiences. So I guess like, you know, the gender pay gap, those kinds of things like that. Having a lack of women in leadership positions, I guess it really affects how you see the world as a woman and your aspirations for yourself. I think like the only really overt experience of sexism that I've had, other than, you know, getting hassled by guys on nights out, was when I was doing modern history for the HSC, and I was the only girl in the class. With the school rugby coach as our teacher, so that was really fun. And every time we watched a war documentary, he'd say to me, "Ruby, if you need to leave the room, that is so fine." And I was like, "Thank you. Is that okay if everyone else leaves the room as well?" I guess like I've never really kind of experienced anything super like overt. I think it kind of is more like a subtle experience that happens. Kind of, I see it more as like a structural thing. So it's, I don't really see individuals as being sexist per se. I think that their behaviours and their actions are sexist, but I think that it's more of a kind of structural thing that society is structured in a way that sexism kind of like manifests in everyday interactions between people.
Cool. And Rani?
Yeah, I think I just want to say first, I really like that we're starting with this question, what is your experience of sexism? Because I think sexism, it's lots of different things, and we're going to have kind of big picture discussions and talk about ideology and stuff like that. But at base level, sexism always is an experience. It's really personal. I think for me, sadly, probably my most extreme experience of sexism was in the family that I grew up in. Quite a patriarchal family. So examples would be, I remember my grandfather casually dropping into conversation that it would be a waste of time for my sister and I to go to university because we'd just end up getting married and having kids. I remember my dad telling me that no one would want to marry me because I was too strong-willed as a woman. And I think growing up, sadly, in my family, just saw a lot of times the women in my family being silenced or sidelined by quite dominant men. So obviously that's had quite an impact on me. But I think from there, growing up, like most of the women in the room, probably have experienced one form of sexism or another, kind of in most spheres of life. So at uni and school, in the secular workforce, in the public space, in some pockets of the Christian community. I think the thing that I want to add to that, though, is I'm very aware that our kind of experiences of sexism here on this panel are kind of part of this broader narrative of sexism that is playing out globally, where I guess you could say women are the most oppressed majority in the world. So I think of things like, you know, the prevalence of domestic violence, female infanticide, sex trafficking, things like that. So I just want to locate our story in that bigger narrative. Mm.
I think the word sexism is a very broad word, and a lot of us take the word sexism into a negative connotation. But I just want to just reinforce that the word sexism fundamentally draws down to stereotyping and limiting a gender because of their biological identity. So my own experiences of sexism, if I had to separate my life according to my family, my career and my aspirations, aside from my career aspirations, I come from a very supportive family, so I've never experienced sexism from my own parents. Say, for example, I'm the eldest of five. There's obviously that obligation for the eldest to give back to their family, but in the situation of I can't help, my dad always helps in, my grandparents have always encouraged my education. In fact, I've seen more support from the male figures of my family than the female figures. In school, I went to an Islamic school. We did have women and men both participated in sports, but I am familiar with many other Lebanese cultures because I don't fit the stereotype, but I do have many female friends that have experienced very extreme forms of sexism, so they've been limited to participate in specific things because they're simply female. Now, in terms of sports or what I do or my own aspirations, many times someone has said to me, I'll give an example. The other day I was playing chess and then a man walked past me and he said, "Oh, what are you doing?" I'm like, "I'm playing chess." And he goes, "Girls don't play chess." I'm like, "Okay, that's a bit strange." But in terms of experienced sexism, it's also important how a woman puts herself forward. If a woman appears to be vulnerable, if she appears to be weak, or she lacking opinion, but she's not confident in putting herself forward, that vulnerability allows her to be exposed to sexism, whereas if a woman is strong-willed and she's confident in her sense of self, you kind of tend to ignore it. So I've never been limited of doing something because I'm a woman, rather, like, I don't want to break off the topic. I have because of my other identity. But having said that, family is a very influential factor in determining whether yes or no that you're going to be subjected to those experiences. So I would obviously, like, I have a great father, I have great male figures, but in terms of even at UTS studying here, in terms of high school, in terms of everything else I've been exposed to, I've never experienced an extreme form of sexism.
Great, thanks. I think it's really helpful for us as we kind of go forward to hear those experiences to know, like, where you're speaking from. So thanks for that.
Just one second. I just don't want to deny that sexism does not exist.
Oh, no, you're right.
Sexism exists in every culture. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just happen to be the lucky one that's born in a good family.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So our next question is, how do you respond to claims that your worldview is sexist? And I'll get Rani to start this time, please.
Yeah, cool. How do I respond to claims that my worldview is sexist? Listen, I really understand why people might think that Christianity is a sexist worldview. I know that there are heaps of women out there, and maybe some of you or women known to you who have had the experience of being mistreated or undervalued by Christian individuals or the church as a whole because of your gender. I just want to acknowledge that. up front, I think that that's something that Christians ought to be deeply grieved by. And I think it really does speak to the fact that the Christian community is and always has been a group of people who are deeply broken and in need of God's mercy and transforming power in our lives. So that really breaks my heart. The thing that I think grieves me even more, though, when I hear this notion that Christianity is a sexist worldview, is that it tells me that I guess the people who say that haven't actually had a chance to get to know the most important person in the Christian worldview, and that is Jesus. I don't know if you know this, but Christians believe that Jesus is the fullest and best representation of who God is and what he's like. And I don't know if you've ever read the biographies of Jesus, the stories about his life, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John. But I'd encourage you to, even after this panel, to go and have a read and do a little bit of a feminist reading and just see what Jesus is like when it comes to women. One of the things I found really fascinating in the last few years is that actually Jesus has very little to say about women at all, actually. He never teaches really about their nature or the different roles that they have. And I think that's just because Jesus sees women the way that God has always seen women, and that is as divinely created and infinitely precious and fully fledged members of the human race. There's this great story that I love in John's Gospel in chapter 4, and Jesus is just kind of sitting by a well with this woman in the middle of nowhere. And we have this conversation recorded with them. And it's quite a deep conversation. They're dialoguing about theology. Jesus is talking to this woman about really personal stuff, her life, the struggles that she's had in her history. And then when the male disciples finally rock up on the scene, John records for us that they were astonished that Jesus was talking to a woman. And of course, you know, we'd kind of expect that, right? They're first century Palestinian men. It's so strange that Jesus is just talking one-on-one with a woman. But the thing that I love about that story is that obviously there's nothing strange or astonishing about it to Jesus. He's just busy talking to this woman as a human being. And I think it's really easy for us to hear something like that in our context and think, well, of course, that just seems so logical, right? But it's worth pointing out that for most of history, and even in a lot of parts of the world today, that kind of attitude to women is seriously against the grain. I think, and you see that all the way through Jesus' teaching and his ministry. Actually, sexism just isn't a logical outworking of Jesus' example or his words at all. And I think that's why throughout history, faithful Christian people in every generation have resisted sexism. Most notably would be in the suffragette movement about 100 years ago, largely made up of passionate Christian women who infused their rhetoric with the language of the Bible. So I think I'm happy to grant that, sure, there are sexist people, sexist Christians out there, but I think they are heavily critiqued by the example of Christ.
Thanks. I'll get Rima to speak next. Thanks.
So, wait, what was the question? Because I'm ignoring your answer.
How do you respond to claims that your worldview is sexist?
How do I respond to claims that my worldview is sexist? This is a very broad question, particularly because Islam is always under the criticism of the media. So first and foremost, as a Muslim, I get all my sources, my viewpoint is influenced by two things. First of all, the Quran, which we believe is the word of God that was revealed through the angel Jibril and the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He communicated these words to his companions. So the first source is the Quran. The second source of information I get my Islamic opinions influenced from is the Sunnah, and the Sunnah is the words of the Prophet. So the first source is the Quran, and the second source is the actions and words of the Prophet Muhammad. The Quran has been subjected to a lot of criticism simply because people take any verse out of context and they just say, you know, the Quran says this and that. So people take a very literalist understanding of the Quran instead of reading it in context. An example of this, instead of, I won't apply it in a Quranic meaning, but let's say that you were reading a novel, you were reading Sherlock Holmes, for example. You know, Sherlock is the detective, Watson is the good guy. And let's say you read the passage where Sherlock struck the man on his head and the man passed away. If you did not read the novel and if you did not know what was happening before and what was after, you would have felt like Sherlock was the bad man in this context. Do you guys get what I'm trying to say? So what I'm trying to say is that the same thing has been subjected to the Quran for the past few hundred years. Islamically speaking, Muslim women had more rights a few hundred years ago than actually now. And I could subject a few of it to colonization. But in the past, we've had various Muslim women who have contributed as scholars, who have contributed as rulers. On the side, a lot of my passions and work is contributed to searching Islamic history sources. And I do a lot of research and articles about Muslim women in history. So when someone tells me that my claim, my worldview is sexist, I'm going to, first of all, tell you the next thing. The interpretation of Islamic sources has been sexist, extremely sexist and taken out of context. An example being is, as a Muslim girl, what I have studied and what I haven't studied. Recently, I came across a verse in the Quran where the Prophet Muhammad, a woman came to him and said, "Well, Prophet, women aren't being revealed in the Quran. How come God's always talking to men?" She went to the Prophet and said, "How come God is only talking to men and not women?" This is a very common question that a lot of girls and Muslim friends of mine will ask our male leaders. And our male leaders will respond, "How dare you say so and so?" So this is for the first example of patriarchy within Islam, within our interpretation. If we go back to what the Prophet did when the woman, her name was Salama, how the Prophet responded to Salama, the first thing he did, he had a silent sympathy. He did not say, "This is the culture of our times." Okay? He didn't know what to say because he understood that this woman had the right for her perspective to be treated. She had the right to be treated accordingly to her needs. A few hours later, the Prophet revealed to his... The Prophet revealed a verse to the people, to his people, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, so God had recognized the rights of this woman, and he revealed a verse in the Quran, and this verse is, "And thus does their sustainer answer their prayer. I shall not lose sight of the labor of any of you who labors, be it man or woman. Each of you is an issue of the other. Hence, as for those who forsake the domain of evil and are driven from their homelands and suffer hurt in my cause and fight for it and are slain, I shall most certainly efface their bad deeds and shall most certainly bring them into gardens through which running waters flow." So a lot of women, when we ask right now to our male leaders, how come women so-and-so, they don't know that they completely, in simple words, miss out the point. This stuff has already happened. We're kind of really in a state of, we went into a state of progression, then regression, then progression. Now, when someone comes up to me and says, because I'm not representing my own culture, there are various arguments you might have against me right now as a Muslim woman. What about the cases of female genital mutilation? Female genital mutilation is not a Muslim problem. It's an African problem, okay? Or child marriages. Okay, child marriages is a problem in Yemen. It's not a problem. It's a cultural problem. As a Muslim woman, I'm a Lebanese Muslim. Let's compare a Lebanese Muslim woman to an Indian Muslim woman. In my culture, I'm expected to marry early by the age of 21. In an Indian Muslim culture, she's expected to marry by the time she's finished her master's and she's working. So you have to understand that. Was that right? All right, cool. So what I'm trying to get at right now is, don't Don't let your stereotypes of Muslim women be influenced by someone's culture. Religion and culture are completely two different aspects. So drawing back to the question one more time, when someone says that my claims, my worldview is sexist, what are you trying to get to? Are you talking about my culture? Have you taken a word without understanding its context? So it's a very, very broad question, and you have to really narrow it down. You can't just say, I heard this on the media. Your argument has to have a series of points to make sense with it, and you have to bridge the difference between culture and religion and practice. So it's a very dynamic question, yeah.
Thank you. All right, and Ruby?
I don't even know where to start after that amazing answer. I guess this is a very challenging thing for me to think about, largely because I guess like my secularism or atheism doesn't really form a huge part of how I see the world. And I think, I guess my answer is similar to Rani's. Like, I think that it's all about the kind of intersections of people's identity. So sure, there might be people who are secular and also sexist, but I don't think that necessarily comes from their lack of faith or religion. I think that comes from other experiences within the world. I think it's kind of more, I see sexism as like a kind of learnt behaviour. It's not something that someone comes out of the womb and they're like, oh man, I hate women. I think it's something that people kind of learn through their interactions in the world. So I think that, it's really hard for me to respond to that. I think there's like definitely things that people could criticise about like other ways through which I see the world, like maybe perhaps that women's labour is undervalued, that, you know, what about the fact that women carry babies for 9 months and do all the domestic unpaid labour in the home and that kind of stuff. If you're looking at like a kind of anti-capitalist perspective, then that's certainly a criticism. But I don't think that like secularism, I mean, it's such a huge kind of amorphous group of people that have many different other ways of seeing the world. So I don't think that necessarily that is a sexist worldview. So that's like really hard for me to respond to, because I think, I would just say, you know, it's not the secularism, it's other parts of people's ways of seeing the world that might kind of have sexist undertones. But again, I think that is something that is learnt, and I think it's about questioning how people kind of come to understand the gender dynamics and power relationships between men and women, which is the kind of more valuable part of that. Yeah.
Great, thanks all of you. So the next question kind of relates to what we just talked about. So you all just talked a little bit about your perspective and where you're coming from. So how does your worldview influence how you respond to sexism? Mm-hmm. And I'll ask Ruby to go first this time.
Okay. I guess my worldview is kind of overthrowing all forms of oppression, however they manifest. So I would see responding to sexism as kind of being about liberating people through their struggles, so supporting grassroots democratic movements in whatever form they might be. And that might not necessarily have a kind of feminist slant to it, but I think that it's important to kind of recognise the kind of different intersections of people's identity in working with movements. So recognising that the experiences of refugee women are different to those of refugee men, for example. Working class women have different experiences to working class men, all those kinds of layers of identity, and recognising that through struggle. I guess like my whole way of solving sexism is to overthrow the system completely. So that, I guess that's the kind of way that I would respond to that, yeah.
Great. And Rani?
Yeah, so I think I'm coming at it from quite a different perspective. I think in terms of responding to sexism, I think there are a lot of good things that I could say about systems and structures and practically seeking change in all of those things and the ways that they perpetuate sexism. I think, though, if you want to tackle something that big, a kind of attitude about women that seems to be so deep-seated and pervasive in all cultures, I think what you actually need is a really robust and strong story about who women are. Because I think the way that we see people, it's always shaping the way that we treat them and interact with them, right? And that's just, I think, as a Christian, the lovely thing about the Bible is that right from the first page, like you only need to flip one page until you hit the creation of Adam and Eve in Genesis. God is just telling this incredibly robust and beautiful story about the radical equality of personhood that men and women have before God. I really love this creation account in Genesis. You can look it up there in chapter 2. It's really old. It's about like 3,000 years old. It's written in an ancient Near Eastern, incredibly patriarchal context. But quite amazingly, the first thing that we learn about women is that they're made alongside men in the image of God. It says God created them, male and female, in the image of God, He created them. It goes on and we learn that men and women are actually made of the same substance. When Adam sees Eve, what does he cry out? He says, oh, surely this is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. Men and women are jointly, interestingly, given the mandate to rule the earth and fill it with no qualifications about their different roles and spheres. And what I find so striking is that in this incredibly patriarchal culture where this text was written, the big point that the author seems to be making is that men and women are actually, in all of creation, more like each other than anything else. They're divinely created, radically equal members of the human race. And that's where the story about who men and women are starts in the Bible. And I just think that as you read and you keep going, that's just amplified. Men and women are equally held responsible as both victims and agents of sin. And when you get to the New Testament and salvation, we see that actually relationship with Jesus is like this great leveler of privilege. It dissolves all the inequalities that we see in society between men and women. So the Apostle Paul writes in Galatians that in Christ there is no Jew or Gentile, slave or free, male or female, but in Christ all are one. So I love that the Bible just has this consistent story about who women are. You know, we're equally made in the image of God, we're co-inheritors of the kingdom of God, we're vital participants alongside men in the church. And I just think that in terms of the first point of responding to sexism, I just think that's a great story to be telling about who women are, to see women the way that God sees them. I think the second thing that I'd add in terms of responding, at least initially, to sexism is I take great hope and comfort as a woman that God is a God of justice. Throughout the Bible, God consistently aligns himself actually with the voiceless and the marginalised and the oppressed. And that's why the Bible is full of people who are crying out to God about injustice. And actually when Christians pray a prayer like, your kingdom come, actually that's in large part what we're asking for. We're saying, God, please just put an end to all this mess and make things right. And as a Christian, to people who experience sexism, I just want to say that God actually hears that cry. He hears that prayer. I think there's so many women in different parts of the world whose stories and cries go largely unheard and whose experiences are largely invisible or certainly not spoken up against for. But God actually says, you might not have a voice with anyone else, but I hear you and I see you and I promise that there will be a day when I will make things right and where every injustice, including sexism and patriarchy, will be exposed for what it is and every perpetrator of those things will be brought to account. And that's not to exclude or downplay in any way the real need and place for action. But I just think... what a comfort and a hope for people who are kind of in the thick of it experiencing sexism as well. I could say more, but I'll be quiet.
Great, thanks, Rani. And Rima, lastly.
So I do agree that God is the giver of justice, and I do believe in a day where God will give the rights to both the oppressed and the oppressor. However, in order for us to work back towards sexism. Rani said before about how when women 100 years ago when Christian women got their rights back to vote. So English women, I think, in the UK wanted to retrieve their rights to vote, and a few women were actually arrested. Okay, it's a bit crazy to imagine this happening at this point in time, but it was only just over 100 years ago. In order for women to not be treated, to not be mistreated, women have to fight for their own rights. Like, a lot of our texts, they have been misinterpreted. They've been taken from a patriarchal point of view. But I would say that the feminism wave in the UK over 100 years ago induced a sense of responsibility in other women all around the world. So this change has been very, very slow, but it's been happening. You know, we have a reducing gender gap. We have a gender pay gap. You know, even the recognition of domestic violence. So I look at a lot of domestic violence as well, and we all obviously know that women experience domestic violence more than males. What I did want to say was the rates in Australia of domestic violence in Australia, the number of reportings against domestic violence in Australia has been increasing. Not because domestic violence is prominent, but because women are recognising domestic violence is a form of injustice, so and therefore they have their rights can be recognised. Does that make sense? My second thing that I want to say is that, so I just want to bridge on to what I'm trying to say, is that women have to fight for their own rights. No one's going to say your story besides yourself. Like, during the Bosnia and Srebrenica war in 1996, when the Serbians invaded Bosnia, it was only then, so 22 years ago, rape actually became a war crime. You know, in the 1920s, I think people from Eastern Europe were still allowed to participate in marital rape wasn't illegal at that point in time. So the only people who are going to fight for you is yourself and the people that believe in your story. Unfortunately, the role of men in this case is to, like from the story I said before about the Prophet Muhammad, is to listen to women and to encourage them and to recognize their rights and their perspectives and their values. So in order for a solution to come, women from all walks of life, from all ethnicities, from all cultures, from all races, have, I guess, an inherent responsibility to fight against it. And by fight, not aggressively, but to deconstruct, like what Ruby said before, that it is systematic. It is present, you know? And we are slowly, slowly, slowly working towards deconstructing it, but we can't, it's still present. So in terms of domestic violence, in terms of rape, in terms of child marriage, kids getting married at 12 to 30 old men, that's bizarre. You know, even someone being told you can't do it because you're a woman. I got told by my manager, actually. I told him I was interested in statistics and quality control, and he was like, women don't like mathematical stuff. And I was like, okay, whatever, I don't really care about you. But the Nobel Prize winner for mathematics, I know she was an Iranian woman, so I guess the actions speak louder than words, so you have to work for it. And, you know, at the end, and, you know, in Islam we have a saying, it's called tie your camel. So the story behind it is once there was a companion. So there was a man, he went to the marketplace and he left his camel, and then he came back, he didn't find his camel there. And he told the Prophet that, you know, I expected God to take care of my camel. And the Prophet is like, tie your camel. So put your efforts in, act first, and then God will support you later on. So as Muslims, like, you know, we don't say, don't just trust in God, you know, tie your camel, invest your efforts, act forward, pursue your rights, and then God will respond according to that. So yeah, that's my answer.
Thanks, everyone. I'm actually going to move us straight into audience questions because we've had quite a lot of quite really good questions come through. So what I'll start off with is I'll do kind of specific questions that have come in for individual panel members, and then maybe if we've got some time at the end, we can do some of the more general ones that you can all comment on. So the first one came through for Rani. And this actually came through a couple of times, but why can't women be leaders in the church? For example, in the Presbyterian system where all the elders are male, why does the church condone this?
Great question. I think I knew that this question was coming. So the question is, why, can you say it again? Is that all right?
Why can't women be leaders in the church, and why does the church condone this?
Sure, why can't women be leaders in the church? Oh gosh, there's so many different ways I could answer this question. I think, firstly, I'd just like to push back a little bit about the claim that the question is making that women can't be leaders in the church. There are plenty of women leaders in the church, plenty of Christian leaders. I think you see that really clearly in Credo, actually. So we're a big Christian organisation, part of the Christian community on campus, and from our staff team and student executive right down to Bible studies, men and women lead alongside each other, and I think that comes from, as I said before, God's vision for men and women working together alongside each other in complementary ways. I think I want to acknowledge that actually there aren't nearly as many women in leadership visible, perhaps particularly the voices of women being heard in certain parts of the Christian community, though that said, the Christian community is so broad that I think that's quite different in different places. I think the New Testament church is a great place to go in thinking about what we'd love to see men and women working together in ministry and in leadership in the Christian community looking like. I think the Apostle Paul, who wrote a lot of the New Testament, assumed that churches would be places that are full of the voices of women. I think he expects that women will pray and prophesy and teach and speak words of encouragement. He talks about plenty of gifts from God in a really ungendered way, I think, because he assumes women will have those as well. And you see that at the end of Romans, actually, Paul has this really long list of all of his different co-workers in Christian ministry, leaders of the church. And he mentions a whole stack of women by name, actually. Tryphena and Tryphosa, Phoebe, Lydia, Junia, people like that. So I actually think there's great grounds for us to see in the Christian community men and women serving alongside each other, using their gifts to the best of their ability, rejoicing to see that happen. I think we probably have a lot of work to do in thinking and talking with each other and God where that isn't the case. That's how I'd respond.
Thanks, Rani. And a question for Rima. This is actually a Quran reference, so I don't know if you want to look it up or if you already know it. So in the Quran chapter 2, verse 282, it speaks about two women witnesses are equal to the testimony of one man. Isn't this sexism?
Can I just get my book? I'm just going to reference it because it's from a scholar. I want to use it word for word.
If you want, we can go to another question while you look it up. Do you want to do that? All right. What I'll do is ask a question for Ruby, maybe while we wait for her to grab that one. Okay. So I've had a couple of questions come through on a similar topic. If we need to overthrow the system, isn't that system for the last 300 years built mostly on a secular worldview? Why hasn't secularism delivered for women?
Great question. I guess, I wouldn't identify primarily as a secular person. That's not a huge part of my identity and a huge part of how I see the world. But that's true. Like, we have kind of lived in under a secular system. We had the separation of church and state and things like that. I guess my answer to that would be the problem I don't see with that is secularism, it's capitalism. So I kind of separate the two. I'm definitely not for like a kind of militant atheist state, but very valid point. I guess I just kind of see that as being separate to what I see as the kind of oppressive part of the system that we live under. But I wouldn't necessarily attribute that to a lack of faith in any way. Yeah.
Great. Thanks for that. So we'll head back to Rima, if that's all right. So I'll repeat the question again. So in this verse in the Quran, it speaks about how the witness of two women is equal to the testimony of one man. Isn't this sexism?
Yep. So the verse is actually chapter 4, verse 11. So it does exist. And to quote it, Concerning the inheritance of your children, God enjoins this upon you. The male shall have the equal of two female shares. So if you take it out of context, if your father passes away and you're a girl, a lot of people have taken this out of context, you inherit half of what your brother gets. So that's a bit unfair. Okay, so I'm just going to quote it word for word because I can't, like, this is a scholarly passage. All right. The majority of classical commentators have said, a woman once came to the prophet to complain after the death of her husband. Okay, actually, before I'm going to read it, let's talk about pre-woman Islam and post-Islam women. Okay, before Islam came to Arabia, men were marrying like 9 women at a time. Okay, secondly, men were like giving their wives to their friends for adultery and fornication purposes. All right, that's the second thing. Third thing, girls were being buried because babies were being buried because they were girls. So all of this was happening in pre-Islamic Arabia. So you have to understand there was a completely sexist and patriarchal society where a woman, like, her husband would just sell her off, okay? So in this story, let's put some characters. All right. You're my husband. She's my brother, okay? This is a story. Husband, she's my brother, okay? Siobhan passes away, and I have a kid, and she has to give my money so I can support me and our children. But my brother comes out of nowhere and takes all of Siobhan's hard work and efforts, and I'm you know, his wife. So basically, this is what happens in the story, where a brother took the possessions of his sister after her husband passed away. Okay, so what happens is in this verse, where's my tremendous effect? All right, so what I'm trying to say is that was the context of this verse. But, you were talking about the wrong one. I was referring to inheritance. You were talking about Islamic legal.
So the question was about how the witnesses of two women are equal.
Of two women. That was completely taken out of context as well. There's another verse that recognizes the testimony of women. Sorry, I took that completely out of context. I was so driven. I'm a product on my own. Anyway, what I did want to say is that in Islam we have something called the Hadith sciences. All right, so the Hadith sciences is when the testimony of someone is recognized for the saying of the Prophet. So let's say the Prophet said something. All right, so Prophet Muhammad, so when we study the saying of a Prophet, we study it in chains. So if Siobhan is a Prophet and the Prophet passes away and I'm his first companion and Ruby's his second companion and Rani's the third person who heard this chain of saying from the Prophet, when we study Hadith, so it's called a Hadith, when we study the Hadith, I have to quote it by person to person to person up until it reaches the Prophet. Does that make sense? So it's basically a ladder, it's a chain. In this, the testimony of women is completely accepted, but that's a verse that's taken out of context. So in Islamic courts and rulings, I know in the Ottoman Empire, that wasn't existed at the time. In Al-Andalus, in Islamic Spain, that wasn't existed at the time. So it just depends on which society is actually exercising that. And there are, just also relating to the verse of inheritance, there are 31 cases where a woman inherits more than her brother. I just didn't want to take that. I took two things out of context. But yeah, a woman's rights, a woman's testimony is still wholly accepted.
Thanks. All right, there are so many great questions coming through. Unfortunately, we're not going to get time to answer all of them, but this one's come up a couple of times. So how would each religious worldview justify or explain the notion of submission that secular society says is heavily ingrained in each belief? So I might get Rani to go with that first.
Sure. So submission is a word that the Bible uses to talk about relationships between men and women, not in a blanket way, but in very particular contexts, particularly in marriage. Probably the most, comprehensive treatment of that you can find in Ephesians 5, where the Apostle Paul talks about wives submitting to their husbands and husbands loving their wives. I think it's a very loaded word for us in our context. We kind of hear submission and we sort of cringe. I think, though, when you actually unpack what that looks like, particularly in a marriage relationship, it's nothing like subjugation or being dominated at all. And what makes me say that particularly is the role of the husband that Paul talks about in Ephesians 5. So the role of the husband, sometimes we talk about that in terms of headship, but the model for that is actually the love that Jesus has for the church. And in that particular part of the Bible, Paul kind of unpacks that and talks about, well, how did Jesus love the church? Well, he actually gave himself up for her, laid down his rights and his privileges and his position to actually give her life and to bring flourishing and goodness. And actually, that's the model that Christian men as husbands have for their wives. So when we're talking about submission, that's kind of what women are submitting to. And I kind of see that as submission as a kind of a joyful accepting, actually, of that sacrificial initiative taking love of a husband that is modelled after Jesus. And personally for me, I think that any model of men and women relating that is based on the love, the self-sacrificial love that Jesus had for his people can only be something that is just really beautiful and good. Mm.
Thanks, Rani. Would anyone else like to speak to that question as well?
So the question was talking about the secular perspective of submission in religion. All right, submission in Islam means to succumb to the oneness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, God, and his five pillars of Islam, the six pillars of Iman. In saying that, I can't see the relationship between submission to God and sexist claims. There is one that someone might say that women are told to wear the hijab. So the thing I'm wearing right now is a head covering, and God says in the Quran twice to women to cover her hair and her adornments. But that for me is my way of respecting the commands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Even in some scholars say towards men are obliged to grow a beard. So women have certain parts of their body they have to cover in Islam, and so do men. So what I'm trying to say is that when someone says that my hijab is oppressive, I don't see what it's trying to get to, because I can still work. I'm not limited into pursuing any of my ambitions, whether that be in the form of career progression, sports, intellect, and so on. So I can't. But for many women around the world, it has existed. So I know in Syria, 7 years ago or 8 years ago, an entire school was fired because the women wore the hijab. So this is funny because this is Syria, but yeah. I guess women experience sexism all around the world in some form or way.
Great, thanks. Sorry, I'm gonna have to cut us off really soon. Unless Ruby, do you want to say something really quickly? You're good? Okay, awesome. Thank you so much, everyone, especially for the questions. They're really fantastic. I'm sorry that we didn't get time to go with all of them. Just got a couple of things to say before we finish. But yeah, can we give a round of applause to our panelists?